You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a new year and a new edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 8th of January, 2020, and we have quite a bit to talk about. This show will not, believe it or not, be on Iran. I will be dealing with that tomorrow with Sven, and I've dealt with it on several radio shows already. As always, I'm saying what everyone else either can't or won't. And all to say about it now are two things. Number one, that the main forward American airbase is in Qatar, which is an ally of Iran. The other big one is in Turkey, two of them actually, and those are required for any military action in the Mideast. In fact, Turkey is required for any military action in the Mideast. Turkey also is an ally of both Russia and Iran, and Turkey, I believe it was yesterday, signed a deal on a new pipeline to replace the one that was canceled a few months ago. So Putin is winning all over the place, and, you know, it's funny that suddenly, just like that, no one's talking about impeachment anymore. Isn't that just hilarious? Of course, the problem is Trump actually committed an impeachable offense in killing an innocent Iranian, a general who has not hurt any American, not hurt any legitimate American interests. And as I speak these words, Iran has hit the U.S. in Iraq, with about a dozen or two dozen missiles, which is a very, very measured response. Had the U.S. listened to the Iraqi parliament a few months ago, as I reported, ordering the U.S. to leave, it wouldn't have been a problem. But, of course, they didn't listen to their colonial administration and pack up. This is what happens. Those of you who subscribe to my Patreon account, you know the condition of the American military. You know how it really is in no position to offer a serious force of any size against, I believe it's the 12th largest military in the world and one of the world's largest economies in Iran, who, by the way, on Friday is going to engage in large-scale naval exercises with both Russia and China. So, have fun, Americans. I was kicked off Facebook a couple days ago for 24 hours, my third time, for pointing that out. Note that I said nothing, that people normally get kicked off Facebook for. It was a, news article pointing out that there's going to be naval exercises with Russia, China, and Iran the day after tomorrow. I believe it's this coming Friday. And I wrote, "Keep pushing, dumb Americans," was my caption to that. That earned me a 24-hour ban from Facebook. Now, that's weird. Facebook, I mean, I've said a heck of a lot worse about American military policy than that on Facebook. I say worse stuff than that every day. Something tells me that calling Americans dumb wasn't the reason I got kicked off. I think it had more to do with the fact that because of American stupidity, Iran, China, and Russia are now far closer allies than before. And I didn't even mention Turkey, a former NATO member who has, at a minimum, offered to mediate, is now a very close ally of Russia, and therefore Iran, has always been an ally of Iran anyway. And America is now surrounded by enemies. despite the American media, who doesn't know anything, claiming that Iran is. To be honest, the only weapon that the U.S. has is drugs. And as I've said, drugs and porn, really. And as I've said, my Iran lecture, when was that? It was a year ago? Maybe a year ago. I'll find it. And we'll post it somewhere. We'll probably post it in the Daily Nationalist. I'll do with Sven tomorrow. Because it contains really all you need to know about this conflict and what kind of country Iran is. And Iran's biggest problem is opiate addiction. And I said, I mean, despite having one of the lowest suicide rates in the world, having one of the best rates of mental illness, there's very few mentally ill Iranians, with proof that mental illness is a social disease, not a biological one, or a chemical one. I mean, it has chemical elements to it, but that's not the cause of it. The fact that it has a long border with Afghanistan is a problem. Proving, by the way, that the American military is deep into drug dealing, specifically as a weapon, because it's really hard to explain why a prosperous, mentally healthy country has such a high rate of opiate addiction. I mean, nothing like the Americans, but a very high rate of opiate addiction. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless the U.S. is weaponizing it, as the British did in China a bit more than 100 years ago. I've done a show on the Opium Wars, at least one show on the Opium Wars, and did an appearance on, I think it was either Myth of the 20th Century or Our Interesting Times. I can't remember which one it was that I did another show on the Opium Wars. Opium Wars being really the foundation of our modern conception of free trade. That's, in other words, where the real life manifestation of free trade as a weapon came into existence. So the U.S., I think, is aware that drugs is really the only weapon it has, given the state of the American military. You know, it's not 1950, it's not 1970. Well, heaven knows, it's not 1970. The U.S. lost a major war. And certainly not 1990. And very much like as the British couldn't put together a flotilla like it did in the Falklands in 82, the U.S. can't do what it did in 1991. And this certainly is not Iran. This isn't Iraq under Saddam. This is a very large, much, much larger and far more prosperous, state. And the last thing I'm going to say here is that about 19% of Iran's economy internally comes from oil. I said this many times concerning Russia. As far as its GDP is concerned, not GNP, but GDP is concerned, a relatively small percentage of its internal economy is generated by oil and gas. In fact, Norway has a higher percentage of oil and gas revenues as its primary source of income. As its primary source of GDP than Russia does. This isn't Saudi Arabia here. So Iran is a bit higher, between 17% and 19%. Of course, in all cases, exports are a different matter. Iran is pretty much self-sufficient, which is why the economy grew almost 4% year on year, 2017-2018, and roughly that 18-19, despite sanctions, because sanctions don't mean very much. China and local states in Russia are the big, India, these are the big trading partners. Iran is internally very much self-sufficient. Its oil and gas equipment, for example, is generated internally. Much, but not all, of its military equipment is generated internally. It really doesn't need American approbation for pretty much anything. But we will expand on that on the Daily Nationalist tomorrow. However, I want to talk about another war today. I'm not going to be dictated to by current events. especially current events that we don't know how it's going to end. I have a feeling how it's going to end. But this is a very new current event, at least as far as the shooting war is concerned. And the only thing, okay, I'll say one more thing, and that is, and you know I'm going to say this anyway, please don't listen to a damn thing that the press says, including some of our people. Johnson's Law most certainly applies. Another law, this is maybe Johnson's Law 2, although I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one who has stated it, but not quite in this way. But Johnson's Law 2 says there is an inverse correlation, and this is among the kind of the average American citizen, between the strength of an opinion on a country or a region, especially if that opinion has to do with bloodlust or military action, and the ability to point out the country on a map. In other words, the more mysterious the country, the more the average dumb American wants to bomb it into the Stone Age. You might call this Johnson's Law 2, and it's a law of inverse proportion. Anyway, I want to talk about something closer to me, at least in my mentality, and it is about a war, and it's also about mythology. So it's not exactly separate from what we're talking about today, but it's something that very few, even Russia specialists, know anything about. You know, I've said for many years, actually decades, that Russia is the center of the world. That means Orthodoxy is the center of the world. The U.S. would love for you to believe that, but it simply isn't true. The U.S. is not a superpower. It does not have a first-rate military. It doesn't even have a first-world military much of the time, as Vietnam and Afghanistan and Somalia have proven. We're talking about the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905. I spent a lot of time on this show over the last decade, destroying the myths promoted by American historians and the occasional pretentious journalist concerning Russia's war record. We've done, 2 months or so ago, a show destroying all the myths about the war in the Crimea, at the very end of the reign of Nicholas I. Every English language history will either lie or be mistaken about that war and what it meant. The same is true for the Russo-Japanese War, the beginning of the 20th century. Both wars are considered a loss for the Russian Empire, but the way that the Menshevik history in the West is written, everything is a loss for Tsarist Russia. The truth is that both wars were at worst a draw, at best, a victory. In both cases, because they're not too far apart, actually, in both cases, the revolutionary movement wrote the history that became canonical in both Russia and the West. But many Russian historians of various backgrounds have set the record straight, like with so many other issues, whether it be the Mongols or the Crimean War or Tsarism in general, what kind of common knowledge in Russia has yet to leak into English or French? Part of it is because much of this stuff has not been translated, but that only begs the question, why hasn't it been translated? There are certain things that the English, the Anglo-American historical establishment doesn't want to deal with. And of course, like any establishment, it doesn't want to admit that it's ridiculous. That's kind of built into the idea of an establishment. It does not want to admit this. It will not admit, it may admit minor errors, but it will not admit major errors. The simple fact that the Western powers, especially the U.S., built the industrial potential of the Soviet Union, or the industry of the Soviet Union, even though that's been proven through internal corporate documents 1,000 times, you will not see a major press history of the USSR mention this. Again, that's a major error, and they're not going to admit major errors. They will admit minor errors, but major errors would mean that the establishment itself should be called into question. Thank God, and it is divine intervention, heaven knows, that this is crumbling. As I've said, the internet is the biggest mistake of the ruling class. They completely, because they live in a bubble, they completely misunderstood and underestimated what dissident historians are capable of when they're given a forum. Of course, Google is trying to control this forum. And if anyone, any of you by now use Google, you know, come on, wake up. Go to Yandex or WebCrawler. Google is tightly censored. As always, the Russian press, Russian internet is far freer than the American. Google is tightly controlled and tightly censored, of course, as is Facebook and as is Twitter and everything else. By the way, the very fact that a president is using Twitter for his communications, if that doesn't prove the vulgarity of American politics, and this situation in Iran, let me tell you, if this doesn't prove what Trump really is. And the funny thing is that when he was campaigning, the Iran issue was one of the reasons I don't vote, but it's one of the reasons I was excited about him. Hillary Clinton said the minute she gets into office, now she said this in 2005, but she said this many times since, that she's going to attack Iran. Well, I guess it took Trump a little bit longer. But presidents, at least not since Nixon, presidents often don't make foreign policy. Now, that wasn't the case in this era, because as you know, the Russo-Japanese War had its peace treaty signed in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, through the mediation of Theodore Roosevelt, even though Theodore Roosevelt and the U.S. was hardly a neutral observer. Anyway, the middle and the 19th century, really by the end of the 19th century, the leading European states were trying to carve up regions far from home. And we all know why that is. The rivalry for Russia, France, and to a lesser extent Germany, of course, was Great Britain. Great Britain was always the enemy of Russia then and now, despite the alliance of World War I. Of course, World War II doesn't count because Russia didn't exist. Russian and English interests clashed in Turkey, in Central Asia, and of course, the Far East. Germany was rising quickly, but at the time, this will change very rapidly, but was not considered a major opponent of Britain. That's going to change real fast. Now keep in mind, Russia and France were not hostile towards Germany. That was not the case. The competition was with Great Britain. Now, even Nicholas II, despite being married to Queen Victoria's granddaughter, said very clearly, he read a book by Assisi, and a review by the Grand Duke Alexei Alexandrovich, the Russian Navy, on the Russian Navy. The Grand Duke said that England was Russia's major enemy, and Nicholas wrote, "I completely accept this, like any Russian who knows his native land's history." He wrote that in the margins of the book, actually a review that he was reading of the book. So Nicholas was very much informed in military and diplomatic history. But even the diplomats considered Russia its primary enemy. Prime Minister Gladstone, in a parliamentary debate of 1885, said the following. He said, "The Russian nightmare must be eliminated by some decisive blow." The Russian nightmare. Well, the only thing he could be referring to here, and Gladstone was actually pretty good on the Opium War. That had nothing to do with Russia directly. But in 1896, Nicholas II paid a visit to Queen Victoria as his kind of grandmother-in-law. And the royal family was at the Scottish castle of Balmoral. You did have negotiations between Lord Salisbury and Nicholas on the question of the Black Sea Strait and Egypt. And the main concern, Nicholas learned, was that the security of the Indian possessions were the main issue, and partly because, again, that's where the drugs were being grown. And Nicholas, you know, given where he was and given who his wife was, you know, he said, "The Russian threat," of course in quotes, "resolutely rejects the presence of any unfriendly intention towards India," which is certainly true. Now, it's a common myth that Nicholas II was this kind of weak man, but the British were very quickly convinced otherwise, because when he was first coronated, the British thought, well, he's young, he's kind of inexperienced, we'll make him a tool, especially given who his wife is. But even Queen Victoria, writing to Nicholas, said that she said to him, she said, "It's so important that England and Russia work together because we're the most powerful empires and therefore we're the guarantor of peace. Lord Salisbury and I want us, England and Russia, to understand each other and to live in friendship." Tsar replied that politics is not a matter of private affairs, and we can't be guided by our personal feelings or personal relationships. Now, those are from the letters he exchanged with Queen Victoria. Letters very much like the ones he exchanged with his wife were all written in English. Nicholas, of course, was perfectly fluent in English. And his letters to his wife were all written in English. So finally, the Russians have to translate something. But Nicholas also said in this letter, he said, "I have to say," because, oh, by the way, the issue here, Queen Victoria didn't like the fact that the Russian press had a lot of anti-English sentiment in it. You know, God forbid. Victoria says, "Well, can't you do something about that?" Now, this shows you how free the press must have been in Great Britain at the time. Says, can you control the press in this respect? This is what Nicholas said to Victoria. He said, "I have to say that I can't forbid people to openly express their opinions in the press. Have I often been upset by the unfair opinions about my country in the British newspapers? Even in books that they're constantly sending me from London, they're falsely reporting our actions in Asia, our domestic policy, etc. Now, I'm sure that in these writings, there's no more conscious hostility than in the articles from the Russian press mentioned above." So much for the myth about Russian press censorship. Only liberal states have press censorship. And communist ones, of course. Now, as this is going on, Russia is advancing into the Far East. Port Arthur was occupied in 1897. Port Arthur is at the peninsula just next to what today would be North Korea. France and England fought a war in 1898 over the English Sudan. And so you had extreme hostility almost just in the beginning of the 20th century. And military preparations in France for a major war against Britain were well underway. And in 1898, Nicholas wrote to the French ambassador and he said, or Count Revaux, said, "The real enemy of France is not Germany, but Britain. England is everywhere the enemy of France, in Africa, and it's the same enemy to Russia in the Far East. We must be guided by this consciously in our policy." They wanted the Franco-Russian, and Nicholas was very clear about this, to make sure that it had a strong anti-English orientation. General A.N. Kropotkin presented Nicholas a plan that he wanted troops in Turkestan and Amur area, the Trans-Caspian region, and even the Kwantung Peninsula. All of these to be put on alert. Now, Nicholas said, Well, he approved them, but he said visible preparations on our part would be, he said they would not be useless. And he said something interesting. He said, why is England alone entitled to arm herself so boldly in the midst of universal peace? It sounds very much like how Putin is talking to the Americans. But Nicholas was ready to join military operations, but only in the event of an attack by England on France or obviously on Russia. And Nicholas said that the bold and arrogant behavior of England won't last long. And I think he thought maybe he could have some influence over British policy, at least because of his connection to Victoria. Now, in Paris, the French and Russian general staffs were meeting, and the convention actually had been signed in 1893. But then, remember, the Triple Alliance was extended to England. This did not mean that it was automatically against Germany. Remember what happened here. Germany and Russia were not opponents. Russia's, and this was very, very clear at the time, Russia's connection with any military alliance was not anti-German, it was a way to control Great Britain. Russia was quite willing to join with Germany if Britain got too uppity, which is really almost a contradiction, an absolute, you know, it's not a contradiction, but it's inherently part of the British Empire in that respect, to be uppity. But he was quite willing to join with Germany in that case. Very few people know that in 1900, Tsar Nicholas supported the Boers in South Africa against Great Britain, and this is something that irritated the British very much. In a letter to Grand Duke Sergei Alexandrovich again, Nicholas stated the following. I sincerely wish the Boers even greater successes than they've had so far. And he wrote a letter to his sister, the Grand Duchess Xenia. He said that he cannot but be joyful over the news that he just heard, that General White's attack, there were two British battalions and a mountain battery captured by the Boers. And there's an explanation point there. He was extremely pleased with the Boer victory at that time over Britain. Now, between March and June of 1900, that changed, and the tide turned towards the British. And that's when the British invaders unleashed that bloody terror against the Boer civilian population through these, you know, scorched earth tactics. And that's when the concentration camps were erected, including, you know, women and children, anyone who was suspected of assisting the Boer partisans. And this barbarism affected Nicholas II very much. The Minister of Foreign Affairs, of course, was Count von Lambsdorff. And he was going to try to intervene in the summer of 1901. And Lambsdorff appealed to the non-English European powers. He said that only the joint representation of the continental powers, along with Russia in favor of the Boers, could persuade England to stop the merciless reprisal against a completely ruined and defeated enemy. And then on June 28th of 1901, Lambsdorff had, right around the same time, Lambsdorff informed the ambassador in Paris, Utosov, that this appeal to the great powers, and great powers acting in concert to appeal to Britain to, quote, provide assistance to alleviate the plight of the Republic of South Africa. Unfortunately, at the time, Russia was alone in this. And Russia had no support in support of the Boers because the war was coming to an end, and the ending of the war was very obvious. And so, according to every European power except Russia, assisting the Boers would have been a waste of time. And as we all know, in 1902, the Boers were forced to recognize the British protectorate, so-called, over themselves. Now, I say all this, that the entire diplomatic staff, military corps, and Nicholas II realized that Britain was its main enemy. The fact that it sided with the Boers, that it sided with the French in Sudan, all the rest of it meant that it was going to spill over into the Far East. Now, the new king, Remember, Victoria died in January of 1901. The Queen was more concerned with Germany than Russia. The new king, Edward VII, was a Russophobe. And that became kind of the standard establishmentarian idea in England. Nicholas considered Edward the most dangerous and deceitful schemer in the world right now. So under Edward, the ruling class kind of engaged in kind of reconciliation with France, which meant that it was going to confront Russia and Germany together, which was a very bad idea for London. And Paris, of course, with a lot of investments in Russia, was iffy about this whole thing. And the British had even sought a rapprochement with Germany, which failed. So, you know, the 20th century dawns, it looks like it's going to be a Russia-German alliance, which the French and the British knew could never last. And in fact, any connection between France and Britain couldn't last, except given how fast Germany was going to be growing here in a minute. But once Germany and France were not considered immediate threats to England, England then began to focus entirely on Russia, and in this case, it was in the Far East. And it was clear that the Chinese, Korean, and Japanese markets were essential to British capital. Russian diplomacy was very active in Manchuria. The simple way to put it is that, you know, Russia had bet on China, Britain had bet on Japan. That was a bad bet in the Russian case. We talked about the Manchu or Qing dynasty in China and what was going to happen after those wars, after the rebellions, starting with the Lotus Rebellion in the, that's the end of the 18th century. The Manchu dynasty was tottering. 1902, the military alliance between Japan and England was directed against Russia, and this was signed. And the desire to stop the advance of Russia in the Far East, including on its own territory. And then, had an alliance of Russia and the United States. And Teddy Roosevelt even warned France and Germany, in the case of an anti-Japanese combination in alliance with Russia, and this is Teddy Roosevelt saying this, I will immediately sign with Japan and will not stop in the future of anything that would harm its interests. Which is an odd thing for him to say. But when he says, I am going to side with Japan, he means I'm going to side with, Great Britain. China, as we know, is in an advanced state of collapse. All these rebellions, remember, plus the Opium Wars were, of course, backed by the West. The Opium Wars were, against Britain. And the rebellions all were backed by British guns. Either supplying them or having the open support of the British Empire. As you know from other lectures I've given, Russia was also very close to the Dalai Lama in Tibet. So it wasn't just China itself, but it was also Tibet that Russia, and as you know, the prophecy in Tibet that the great white czar in the far north, or the great white king, I should say, in the far north, will come to the defense of Tibet. Remember, China had ruled Asia for 2,000 years and was now, thanks to the British, entering a period of decay and violent upheaval. And the British press, of course, you know, one of the most advanced civilizations in the world suddenly became this backward feudal tyranny, showing you the ignorance of journalists in Britain, very much like the ignorance of journalists in America. So one of the most powerful scientific and literary empires of the world now was a backward satrapy in the eyes of the British press. And therefore Russia is included in this because Russia was trying to buttress Chinese power. But the rest of the Western powers were very pleased with the power vacuum it created. There's a famous cartoon of the powers dividing up China, and Russia is one of them. And this just isn't true. Russia was trying to keep that from happening. So even in cartoons, they can't get it right. So the Russo-Japanese War can only be understood with this background. A coalition was forming, Japan, England, the USA, to the Russian and Chinese desire to implement the Great Asia Program, a bit like the later Japanese co-prosperity sphere. So the Japanese attack on Russia was welcomed both by England and the US. In the winter of 1904, the Daily Mail said that Russia must be destroyed. This heavy mastodon, ready to swallow all of Asia, had gone too far. We're going to talk about what that means here in a minute. England said it will not only provide Japan with financial assistance, but military assistance. The Irish Corps received orders to immediately leave for India, and the fleet reservists were to report their addresses to London, the London Admiralty, and the British company, Gibbs, which was their military supplier, had bought Chilean and Argentinian armored ships for the Japanese government. Again, showing that these were, by the way, two Latin American first world powers, that London is using them for its military equipment, but in this case being sent to Japan. But the ships were actually built in Latin America, bought by Britain, and sent to the Japanese. So London's concern, though, was to build Japan up, but not too strong. They liked Japan's successes, but so long as they weren't too significant. But they weren't going to continue to support Japan if Russia was going to win this. Edward VII, in 1904, in an interview in Copenhagen, he said, "The conclusion of the Anglo-French agreement gives me hope to achieve the same results, great results. The conclusion of a similar agreement with Russia, whose opinion always and continues to be the object of my sincere desires, is in my interest." Of course, he wasn't telling the truth there. He still thought maybe Russia could be turned. But Nicholas, being extremely intelligent when it came to diplomatic things, saw in that statement the desire for England to be the mediator here. In other words, to create a very favorable peace with Japan. So the Tsar wrote Edward VII and said, "You know, we had very similar opinions about your intentions in the Boer War. We did not intervene." And of course, the king was extremely unhappy with this comparison. But believe it or not, Edward said that the British are going to remain neutral over there, despite, you know, building up Japan. The most that Edward was willing to say is that, you know, join us in Japan, or at least be neutral in Japan's expansion, and we will guarantee your possessions in southern Manchuria. Of course, Nicholas is not an idiot. Well, of course, he would only do this if Russia pulled out of the Korean region. So it became pretty clear that negotiations were out of the question. On the night of October 8th and October 9th into October 1904, the British, you know, we talked about this in the Opium Wars. The British were excellent when it came to creating false flag attacks to justify military action and to justify press hatred of Russia. We talked about what they did in the Opium Wars with the fake poisoning and in the bakery in Hong Kong and other things. Well, here's the false flag that happened in October 1904. As the Russian ships were leaving the Baltic ports to get their way all the way to the long trip over there to the Far East, ships of the 2nd Russian Squadron were attacked by — this is in very heavy fog, by the way — they were attacked by several English destroyers. Now, at the time, there was no contact between the ships, and their affiliation couldn't be established at the time. They sailed only with lanterns in very heavy fog. Now, these destroyers moved only in areas where there were heavy British fishing interests. So they were surrounded with fishing boats. So the British ships fired on the Russian squadron, the Russians returned fire, but the destroyers very quickly retreated into the fog, leaving only the fishing boats there, which is a pretty dirty trick. And of course, a few of the Russian shells hit the civilian fishing boats, which the Russians didn't even know were there. The minute the fishing boats were discovered, Rostovensky, who was the admiral, or the vice admiral, D.P. Rostovensky, ordered that the firing be halted. It was a very dirty trick. Now, there were two dead English fishermen, six wounded, and one of their trawlers were sunk. This was called the Gull incident, because this was near the English port of Gull. And needless to say, you know what the British press and the American press were saying. The Russian Navy kills, for no reason, English fishermen. Of course, no one asked why in heaven's name the Russian Navy would shoot an unarmed fisherman, but that's not what the media is supposed to do. They're supposed to simply do what they're told. The Reuters news agency, which was British, on October 10th, stated that the attack by a Russian squadron of English fishermen, and by the way, they doubled then tripled the number killed, they were saying that hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, were slaughtered by the Russian Navy for no reason. The Russians have shown their true colors. The English historian, so-called, R.M. Cannington, said the attack on the fishermen was perceived as an attempt on the status and dignity of Britain, the mistress of the seas and a great power. So the press began talking about the inevitability, that famous modern word, the inevitability of a war with England and Russia. Nicholas then wrote, "What abominations, what lies and slander are spread by the English newspapers about Russia." Then Nicholas sent a telegram to Edward with words of regret and condolences. I don't even know if they had sent him the full information exactly what happened. The Russians said, you know, we're pretty sure that fishing trawlers don't have those kind of guns, so we're pretty sure the Navy was there and simply retreated into the fog. And so when the Russians returned fire, there were only civilians there. Classic false flag. And the fact that the destroyers were British was never mentioned, or that they existed at all. Again, showing you what the so-called free press really is. And then calls for war were everywhere. No different than Iran today. The Times said that England only has one option left. And very, very, this is not reported, not in history books on the area. You're not going to hear this. Now, of course, in mid-04, you know, you had already, you know, the Gull incident happened in October, but even long before then, you had an attack plan on Russia in the Far East, needless to say. Now Wilhelm II took advantage of this, and he concluded a Russo-German Union Treaty used to put pressure on France. And the point was to put, so all three of them, to put pressure on London not to engage any aggression on Russia. And so Russia had succeeded in putting the so-called Gull incident into international hands, the so-called International Convention. And of course, the Russians would not permit the detaining of the squadron, the second squadron. Now Britain is panicking because this isn't working out how they thought, and it created a Russo-German alliance. Now, anti-Russian sentiment was stronger than anti-German, but the anti-German sentiment was very powerful too. So you had a Russo-French alliance and a Russo-German alliance. And therefore, in response, among other things, the British began deepening their alliance with Japan. This, by the way, is one of the origins of World War I, because Britain was surrounded by this point. to breaking the Russo-German alliance was absolutely essential. And as we all know, Austria, without realizing it, ended up being the way this was broken. Austria, that is, attacking Russian allies in the Balkans. And it's a shame that Wilhelm II didn't see this coming, even though he did sympathize for a while with the Serbs and didn't like the idea that he was connected with the Austrians. By the way, I promise to talk about the actual war here in a minute. But there simply is no way to understand the war, which didn't last very long, without any of this. So, of course, we need to talk about the rapid development of Japan. China and Korea, her closest neighbors and relatively weak at this point, became the object of Japanese expansion. Really is, you know, and in 1894, the Sino-Japanese War began, which the Japanese won, and the resulting treaty with which the British were involved. The 1895 treaty gave Japan an indemnity, of course, but also gave her Taiwan, the Penghu Archipelago, and the Liaodong Peninsula, which is just to the west of the northern part of North Korea, not too far from Peking, on the Yellow Sea. That's where Port Arthur was located. Now, Germany, Russia, and France together did force Japan to abandon the Liaodong Peninsula, and it was the Germans who occupied the Chinese port of Qingdao and deployed the East Asian naval squadron. Now, Wehawei was leased from China by Britain, and in 1898, the British turned this into a major naval base. And it's funny because, you know, the Russian policy in Port Arthur was condemned, but the Germans and the English were never condemned for doing the exact same thing elsewhere. Now, Japan received from China far less than she expected. It wasn't enough to dominate Asia. But as Russia began building its own Far Eastern territories, both Japan and Britain were getting upset. The Japanese demanded of Russia that she recognize her own predominant interest in Korea, but was willing to accept Russia in Manchuria, but only with regard to her railway interests. St. Petersburg was going to yield on the Korean question, but said, we won't do this unless you agree not to use Korea for military purposes. Anything north of the 39th parallel should be a neutral strip of territory, and neither party should have a military base there. That's where Japan said no. And that's what began to worry Russia very much. England, of course, had a lot to do with her opinions in this matter. These negotiations progressed. Japan became more and more militant, suggesting that Britain was backing them, giving them money, and offering them support throughout. So Tokyo was on a war footing. Now, the war itself was decided largely from the land battles on the Manchurian front. The sea war had nothing to do with any of this. The fleet, of course, was built by the USA, to a lesser extent Britain. And given Russia had just begun to build its presence in the Far East, the Japanese Navy surpassed the Russian in the number of ships, the armor, the firepower, the speed. And the Japanese were landing men without hindrance because of the relative weakness of the Russian Navy at the time. Port Arthur was very easy to block up. And the Japanese were able to dominate it without much work. The naval battle from July to August of 1904, the Tsushima battle, really couldn't affect the main war, which was on land. The Japanese war plan essentially was to use Russia's unpreparedness. So it built its forces and instituted the draft very quickly. The point was to destroy the Russian infantry, to capture or at least surround the Russian Navy, but at a cost that won't harm its expansion elsewhere. Now, as far as Russia goes, the Japanese plan was to encircle and capture and destroy eventually the Russian army in Manchuria. And of course, at a relatively low cost. And of course, none of this happened. Therefore, the Japanese didn't win. There were three general battles. The Liaoyang, which is on the Taizi River. The Battle of the Shaho River, which is along the Mukden Port Arthur Spur of the China Far East Railway, just north of the Liaoyang in Manchuria. And Mukden at the end, which today is called Shenyang, not too far from the North Korean border. All of these are in the far northeastern part of China. In none of these battles were the Russian army defeated. The Japanese commander was Marshal Oyama. He failed to encircle the Russian troops. And frankly, Japanese losses were greater than Russian. And they were far more than a relatively small country could bear. Battle of Liaoyang took place in August of 1904. The Russian army was concentrated in southern Manchuria under Kuropatkin and reached about 140,000 men. They were attacked by three Japanese armies under the command of Oyama, totaling about 125,000. After 12 days of fighting with great losses to the Japanese, Kuropatkin, worried about losing communication with the rear, began to order a general withdrawal. Now, here's the thing. Kuropatkin's withdrawal of the Russian forces, an order was issued 2 hours before the Japanese commander had ordered his withdrawal. Had they waited two more hours, they would have actually won that entirely. It would have been a Japanese catastrophe. But that was more or less a draw. The Russians withdrew in perfect order, but the Japanese did not pursue because their losses were gigantic. The Japanese failed entirely. They occupied the city of Liaoyang, but that certainly didn't justify the massive losses that they endured. It was nothing but a symbolic victory. Replenishing its forces was very, very difficult. The next was the Shaho River. The Russian army by this time had reached about 200,000 men, the Japanese about 170,000. It was about 2 weeks. The front was about 40 miles long. Now, the Japanese figures said that the Russian casualties were 42,000, the Japanese about half that, but again, those are Japanese figures. The battle at the Shaho River showed that the balance was established, and really both commanders were incapable of winning. In Manchuria, beginning of 1905, we had about 300,000 Russian troops in Manchuria. But the Siberian Road saw, you know, it was fully built. I made an error in my Third Rome saying that it wasn't quite finished yet, but it still wasn't able to bring, you know, about 14 pairs of trains a day were coming up the Siberian Road, but at the beginning of the war, it was only 4. But here's something I did say. Russia wasn't strained at all in this war. Even the loans, I mean, of course, all governments have to take loans out short term to cover expenses. Russia was able to take out loans at 5%. Japan had to pay 8%, despite British backing. In other words, the banks, these are mostly French in this case, thought that the Russians were winning or going to win, and that's why the Japanese had to pay a higher rate. Everyone knew that Russia was going to win a war of attrition because Japan was absolutely at its maximum. The last battle was Mukden, February of 05. That front was 125 miles long and lasted about a month. The Russian army was about 330,000. Japanese were at about 270,000. Now, remember, the Russian army was spread out all over the place. The Japanese in the battle had numeric superiority because the Russians were involved in construction and other things. So the combat strength of the Russian forces were only about 58% of that. The Battle of Mukden was indecisive. Actually, all these battles were indecisive. With the fact that the Japanese were essentially on their home territory. Again, the Russians had withdrew slightly, but this did not justify the massive Japanese losses. And this is why no one can say that these were Japanese victories, or if they were, they were Pyrrhic victories. The total losses of Russians killed when captured were 89,000. The Japanese were roughly 71,000. But there were 59,000 killed in Russia, but in Japan it was 70,000. But Mukden wasn't decisive anyway. The Japanese failed to encircle or destroy the Russian troops, and now the Japanese could not replenish their losses. Russia had no problem. Japan was absolutely straining at its maximum mobilization potential. And yet, the press throughout the world said this is an unprecedented and shameful defeat. Marshal Aoyama was unable to defeat the Russian forces, and Japan was completely exhausted. Once peace was concluded, for 6 months afterwards, the Japanese army did nothing, since it could not. Ultimately, Japan was able to call up 1 million men, but they were doing this by calling up kids under 17 and men over 45. Japan was drawing forces for the defense of Japan itself. The Russian forces eventually grew to 788,000. Japan could muster at most 446,000, and that was absolutely straining every bit of manpower it had. The cost of the war was about the same for both sides, but Japan's military budget grew 85%. Russia's didn't grow at all. 135,000 Japanese were killed, with 554,000 wounded. Total casualties in Russia were about 400,000. That includes dead and wounded and captured. Foreign observers, though, foreign military observers from around the world said that Japan was defeated, and that only the peace in June of 1905 saved Japan from total defeat and catastrophe. Throughout the war, Japan tried to negotiate with Russia, because Japanese resources were absolutely failing. It didn't have the men or the money to continue this war. It was at 105% mobilization. Russia was hardly mobilized at all. It was a tiny percentage of her budget. So why did Russia, in August 1905, conclude peace? It was because the British press, the Russian press, was screaming that Russia was defeated when it was not. And therefore, this emboldened the leftist revolutionary movement to destroy railways, to destroy materiel depots, and convinced the army that they were losing when in fact they were not. The Japanese commander, the siege of Port Arthur, Matsuke Noge, committed suicide. Now, we haven't spoken about Port Arthur, but Nogi went to the emperor in January of 1906 and said he was going to commit suicide for his defeat. The emperor said, "You will not kill yourself." He said, "I perfectly understand." This is the emperor speaking. He said, "I perfectly understand the feelings that make you want to commit seppuku and thereby apologize, but now is not the time to die. If you insist on committing suicide, let it happen after I leave this world." The general stated, "I have no excuse to offer to my sovereign and my countrymen for this unscientific, unstrategic use of brute force." And that was his letter to the emperor. In other words, that he lost. And eventually did kill himself. So the siege of Port Arthur was universally called a defeat for Russia, but it was not. It was a massive miscalculation by the Japanese. August 19th of 1904, the first assault on the city began. This is a massive, remember, this is a fortress city that hadn't even been completed yet. The first attack, and this again, this is why the general killed himself, failed and suffered massive losses. Port Arthur did not fall. The Japanese should have abandoned any idea of capturing the city by storm. But it continued to attack it. The Port Arthur garrison was better off than the enemy, even though this was in, you know, Japan's home base. They couldn't leave the fortress because that would have put them, made them exposed. So reinforcements arrived from Japan. September 19th, Japanese attack for a second time, which failed with massive losses from the Japanese. The Japanese army was beginning to strain. The Japanese military analysts failed and underestimated how strong the Trans-Siberian Railway was. So, on October 30th, a third attack occurred on the city with the same very sad result. Japan received more reinforcements, and after a month, a fourth assault took place, this time from two sides. And this also failed. Non-stop shelling destroyed much of the fortifications. A fifth attack also failed. And that was the Battle of Port Arthur. How in heaven's name is this a defeat for Russia? It was a defeat because the press said it was. The fact is that General Nogay was foolish to try to attack the place five times, and this is why he offered his life to the emperor. Well, I'm not sure. I'm at the end of my hour here. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a part two of this. It may not be enough for a part two, so I may do the end of this next week and add something else. We'll see, but there will be a part two of this. Now, that, although, is the military background and the actual battles of the war. In what respect is this a defeat for Russia? The very fact that the supreme commander of the, or the, actually the emperor's supreme commander, but the supreme military commander of the Port Arthur battle kills himself because of five ridiculous failed attacks, which decimated. The casualty figures I mentioned did not include Port Arthur. Decimated the Japanese military. This is why when Japan signed the peace treaty in New Hampshire, they said, we are absolutely exhausted. The only reason it was considered a defeat is that the Russian press said so, proving what journalists really are. So many of the journalists were educated in the West and wanted to see the Tsar fall. There were riots in Japan. The government almost fell. It was seen as a massive humiliation and defeat. And when the general kills himself, and he does, the emperor will soon die, and he will commit harakiri, and that'll be the end of him. So much for a Japanese victory. The Japanese suffered monstrous losses. And yet every history of the Russian Empire that you will read in English will talk about this humiliating Russian defeat. No, Japanese attacked the city five times and failed and lost a massive number of men and material. And unfortunately, the general who did fight very foolishly committed harakiri. Now, we'll talk about the rest of this and a few other scattered issues, probably Iran again, who knows, depending on what happens next week. So anyway, guys, thank you for listening. As always, thank you for donating to me. And as always, I thank my donors who keep me alive and keep a roof over my head and cat food for the cats, although they don't deserve it because they're bad and they work for the MI6. But guys, thank you for everything. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.